This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Hello, everyone. I'm Madeline Morris. Welcome very much this evening to Crime and Punishment, which is a co-production of the Wheeler Centre and Arts House. This evening we're going to be discussing issues of crime, punishment, prison, rehabilitation, criminality, and justice. So I am your host for this evening. We're just going to let a few more people filter in, but we better get kicking off, otherwise we'll never get out of here. And there are so many things to discuss this evening. We're going to have to kick it along. I host the Question Time series for the Wheeler Centre, and my day job, that's by night. By day, I'm a reporter for the 7:30 program on the ABC. So this is really appropriate to be having this discussion this week because never, that I can remember in the news cycle, have we had a more staggering reminder of the precarious balance that needs to be struck in the criminal justice system as we watch the horrors of what has gone on in the Don Dale Centre in the Northern Territory. But in truth, these matters are never really far from our minds. Here in Victoria, we've been discussing over the past couple of months the rise in youth crime, the crimes of carjacking, home invasions, how best to deal with that. On the national stage, we're looking at terrorism and whether we should be changing our laws to keep people in prison who've served their time but who we think aren't safe to release into the community. So these issues are never far from our mind, and particularly if any of you have ever been either involved in crime or punishment yourselves, then this will be something that is never too far from your mind. So some of the things that we're going to be talking about this evening: what is the purpose of punishment? Is it to make law-abiding members of society feel catharsis, or is it to change behaviour? What role does rehabilitation and should rehabilitation play in our prison system? Dostoevsky wrote 150 years ago in Crime and Punishment, the question is, am I a monster or am I myself a victim? And what if I am a victim? And those questions are still as relevant today. So we're going to be discussing these questions today with our panellists as well as all of you. Our audience today includes some members of the chat. And I can see some cast members of the chat, I should say, and I can see that a number of you, recognising you, have also been to see the chat, which was a fantastic performance just an hour ago. Great to see John and James there as well. So I will introduce our panellists in a moment, but before we begin, I'd like to pay my respects to the elders of the Kulin Nation and acknowledge that we are meeting on their land today. I pay my respect to their elders past and present and to the elders of any other communities who may be with us today, and in particular, Jack Charles, actor, musician, Boonwurrung elder and a national treasure who has spent more days than he probably cares to remember detained at Her Majesty's pleasure. Peter Norden is our second panellist sitting next to him. He's an adjunct professor at RMIT. He has more than 30 years' experience working in the criminal justice system, the social system, and he was also the senior chaplain at Pentridge Prison, which is some of the experiencing that he'll be drawing on today. Debbie Kilroy is a lawyer. She's just down here. And she's the founder of Sisters Inside, which fights for the human rights of incarcerated women and their children. And to date, she's the only former female prison inmate who's been admitted to the bar in Queensland. Just next to her is Susan Shepherd. Susan had a long career as a dominatrix, and she's currently writing a book on the sex industry, as well as studying for a degree in literature. And she's also spent time in prison and is now a passionate prison activist. And JR, or James Brennan, is a former creative producer, director and composer, as well as a former parole officer in New South Wales. And he is the co-creator of The Chat, on whose set that we are sitting today. And a big round of applause for James, for those of you who saw The Chat this afternoon. It's a fantastic performance. Why don't we begin with you, Jack? Because as I was saying in my introduction, we have never had a more pertinent reminder of the difficulties of our prison system, our criminal justice system, than this week. What did you think when you saw those images coming out of Don Dale?
I wasn't surprised. I think that's probably been happening in those locations and others around there for a long time. And I think that's probably the most important thing to acknowledge about that, is that that's nothing new. And it's shocking, but it's not surprising.
And Jack?
I believe that Adam Goods, I mean, not Adam Goods, Mr. Giles and all the members of his party should resign their position because this is the rush too quick. You know, as much as the rush of Mr. Abbott's to get white people to vote yay or nay on their behalf in regards to changing the constitution and reconciliation, etc. It's a push too soon. Mm. They need to have a royal commission independent of Northern Territory. So what's happening now is a whitewash. It's useless for us.
And I mean, so you weren't shocked when you saw those images of what were being done to those children?
Oh, no, it's the same thing.
I think the rest of the community was extremely shocked, but
same thing happened, well, in the home that I lived in. If you were naughty, you were made to put on a pair of boxing gloves and locked in the gym with a bigger boy whose job was to bash some sense into you. And that most of them bashed me, but there was one who didn't. He refused to do it. So I took my first acting class in that gym privately. He said, listen, I'll bash you. My glove against the other glove, and they'll hear it outside because they're listening, and we want you to go out crying, Jack, okay? Mm. So I acted as though I'd been bashed and things like that. But that was common practice, you know? If you ran away from Bayswater Boys' Home and they caught you and sent you back there, the bigger fellas bashed you for that, and they would have been paid something for that.
But how many years ago was that, Jay?
Oh, many years ago, yeah. But I mean, it's still happening.
So, Debbie, when you saw what was going on in Four Corners, the footage that they showed, was that of any surprise to you?
No surprise at all. But before I do continue to speak, I do want to acknowledge that we are on Aboriginal land, always have been, always will be. I want to acknowledge elders past and present. I want to acknowledge Uncle Jack and other Aboriginal people who are here today. Because we as white fellas have to understand and know and gain knowledge of the invasion of this country and the fallout of that. And what we see, the fallout from that invasion and stealing land from the First Peoples of this country, is a clear indication of the trauma and the outcome of that theft when we walk into our prison system. So when that footage was released, like, we've seen that footage and those images before. Koori Mail had them on the front page of the paper a couple of years ago. But it's interesting that, you know, a reputable mainstream media outlet, being Four Corners, pieces all the bits together with a story, and then white Australia sees it and there's white outrage. This happens in our prisons every day, in our youth prisons and our adult prisons. This is not something new to any of us that have lived in the prison or who actually go in and out of prisons, you know, and those who work and cover up the violence. Because prisons are perpetrators of violence. That's the actual reality, and that's why we need to abolish prisons. Anyone put in a prison will be traumatised by violence, physical violence, sexual violence, emotional violence, psychological violence. That is the reality. And if that's how we want to live, well, then you cop it on your back, because that's why young people and adults, when they're released, are actually in a worse state than when they were first put in there. And it actually fails us all as a community.
Mm-hmm. Peter, what is the purpose? If we are seeing people coming out of prison in a worse state than they were when they went in, as Debbie said, I mean, first of all, do you agree that that is the case? And if that is the case, then where are we going wrong?
Yes, well, you know, we've got a huge prison population expanding at three times the rate of the national population in Australia. For the last 20 years, it's been increasing at three times the rate of the national population. But what happens from, you know, when you have that prison experience is that you get more and more disconnected. I mean, one of the first things that happens in prison, if you break even small regulations, you lose your contact visits. You just get a box visit behind glass with a telephone. And therefore, you lose your connection to the significant others. And you therefore, when you're released, you're not going to be connected. So if the prisons were really about trying to prevent reoffending, you'd be building those connections. You'd be dealing with the issues in the community that would have led someone to commit a crime. But, you know, I was up in the Northern Territory last year and they've just opened an 1,100-bed prison with a population of 200,000. And it cost, I can't remember how much, it cost hundreds of millions to build and something like 60, 70, 80 million each year to run. I was doing a crime and punishment forum for NAJA, the legal aid group up there. If they could get just one extra million a year, or one of my graduate students was there working with family conflict, if the organisation she was working with had an extra $1 million a year, they could do so much more. But instead, huge resources, not just in the territory, but around the country, are being poured into building and operating prisons, right, just like they've done in the southern states, as Jack referred to before, Florida, Texas. They're now the pendulum swinging. And surprisingly, in those conservative southern states, they're starting to look for ways of limiting their prison population, partly because it's cost them so much. Right. California declared bankruptcy a few years ago because of the prison industry.
The state declared... Sorry, just repeat that. California declared bankruptcy because of the cost of their prison system.
They were spending more on the prison industry than they were on higher education.
That's directly from the American jail show that you see on television and that. Corrections people have gone to these organisations overseas where they're selling these products, restraining chairs and other means and that. And our government is doing this. And from my observation, it seems they're jailing all our young offenders, all our young people up there. You know, if you're Aboriginal and your mum sends you out to buy some bread or some milk, you can be very well picked up without any paperwork and shoved into an institution, and that's your journey into crime, into experiencing prison life and this behaviour that's been allowed to be and is condoned by the government up there. And Mr Giles, he's behaving like a despot from my observations. And by the untruths when he was pulled up and questioned about seeing that footage, he lied. And then he has to backtrack and that, things like that. It's disappointing as an elder like me to see that our next future generation of the young ones up there in the Northern Territory being jailed and their mental imbalance developing from this.
Okay, well, you've just brought up a theme there that I really wanted to touch on tonight. And everyone, this is a forum where you can put your hand up at any time and ask a question. You can put your hand up at any time and make a comment. So please do so. We've got a couple of people with roving mics coming around. I'll come to you in a minute, sir, because I just did want to kick off with what Jack has brought up just there, and that is indeed the journey into crime. And I think the recidivism rates in Victoria at this point are 44%. So 44% of people who serve time are back in jail within 2 years. So clearly something is not working there. The journey into crime is well down the track at that stage. And the question is, where does it begin? And James, I mean, you might have some insight into this as someone who worked as a parole officer and sort of juvenile crime and
I worked with adult prisoners only.
Yeah.
We do what we
presumably started off as juveniles, though.
Yeah, did. What we do know is that sending someone to prison is the strongest indicator that they will go back to prison. That is, we know, the most easily identified element that you can do to someone to make them go to prison is to send them to prison before. So that is one massive issue, I think, that is not really acknowledged in corrections generally, in criminal justice generally. You know, there's these elements of deterrence and punishment, rehabilitation, sure, but actually that fact alone is enough to make one reconsider it.
Why is that? What?
Well, if they're going to go back to jail as a result of you sending them to jail is surely corrections in every state in Australia are trying to reduce recidivism. That's what you can get told as a parole officer. You have a goal, I think it's reduced by 10%, which is completely unrealistic, I should say, in the job itself. But that's sort of a bit of an abstract. I think it's really something that's embedded in our understanding of criminal justice in generally. You know, how much can you shine a shit, you know? And is there something so clearly problematic about our criminal justice system that it's really hard to know how much we can improve it in the current version? I mean, my particular belief about why people are going to prison is a whole complex range of issues, you know, mental health, housing, drug use, violence in communities. These are the things that are helping people be sent to prison, apart from the often outrageous convictions that people get, like Jack had said, which are often unfounded in some areas especially. The fact that the criminal justice system has been heaped with this job of managing these social issues is a problem in itself.
So, but I mean, if we talk about the, if we just stick on the juvenile theme, I mean, is the initial problem that those, lots of those kids who end up on a criminal path are the result of these complex social issues that you're talking about?
I think so.
And yeah, they're not getting what they need in prison. In fact, the words that I hear said quite a lot are they're just getting to be better criminals in prison. Is that the issue?
I think it's really, I mean, it's something you need to look at case by case, and different people get different things out of prison. I mean, Peter Will has had lots of personal contact with people, and I have also, Peter, for a lot longer. And they people get different things out of prison. Some people retreat and sort of survive. Some people turn to, you know, fitting in and stuff, and that certainly can lead to more criminalised behaviour. Mm. It criminalises them. That's what it does. I mean, how you sort of define what happens to them is case by case, but they're criminalised.
So the community expectation, though, is that people will be punished. So this week, for example, in my day job, I've been out in some of the western suburbs of Melbourne talking to people. I'll come to you in a second, Debbie. Talking to people who have been going on patrols because they're so worried about carjackings and the new spate of home invasion. So, you know, really nice, ordinary people live in a very happy neighbourhood. Otherwise, they are terrified. And they are going out in their cars at night time looking for people, looking for youths who appear to be up to no good. You talk to them about the change in bail laws in Victoria, which was enacted recently, which is a presumption of bail for people who are in prison, and also decriminalises breaching bail, and they are furious. They say that is absolutely the wrong thing to do. They say that sends the wrong message. We should be sending these kids away and giving them a lesson. Debbie, and then we'll come to you, John, as well.
I think people think that if you send me to a youth prison, you're teaching me a lesson that you think you might be teaching as an adult. But you're not teaching me that lesson at all. You're teaching me to hate authority, to hate adults, to hate society. Just hate. You're teaching me to hate. I was first locked up as a kid when I was 13 for wagging school. Wagging school. Like, who in this room is wag school? Did you get locked? Like, it's not a joke. And life went downhill because then after I did my 4 weeks for that, because I was supposed to be assessed by a psychiatrist back then to see, you know, what my issues were, and never did, but I was highly traumatised in the youth prison. My father suddenly died. I was blamed for his death by the woman, the matron that ran the place. I was locked in isolation. I was held down by 10 orderlies and given needles on a daily basis to knock me out to sleep. And you want to teach me a lesson to behave myself out here and be part of your society as a child? No, no, no. That doesn't work. You teach children hate, and you teach them to believe that they are bad and they are no good, and they will act that out. And that's what you're seeing. These are our children, they're children, for God's sake. Why do we allow abuse of children and punishment in youth prisons when that's what they are? They're violators, perpetrators of horrendous violence. It has to stop. They have to close. We have to start thinking outside the bars about how we treat our children. And I'm talking about probably not your children, children who are living in horrendous poverty, have social issues because they have no housing, their parents are struggling, there is no employment, they don't have education because the education system is so inflexible to their learning needs. So it's fine to be white, middle class, upper class and fit into all your structures because that's what they're built for, you. Not for kids like us or Aboriginal kids who grew up in poverty and violence and everything else, all those social issues. So when are we going to ensure that we have proper social policy and resources? We do have plenty of resources in this country. We are a very wealthy country, to ensure that no one lives in poverty. No one is homeless. Everyone has access to education and health. It ain't rocket science. But you know what? We as a society value property more than our children and people. And we've actually got to start thinking outside. How many cars can you drive? How many houses can you live in? Well, one, I think, because, you know, and if you're lucky enough to have that. We have to stop valuing property over children, because we're talking about children.
John's one of the cast members of the chat, for those of you who haven't been here today to see it. John, what would you like to say?
I'm part of the chat, and it's a real privilege to be so. You know, look, for me, my story, you know, I was institutionalised from when I was 11 in Belterra. You know, I felt belonged, you know. My father got sick when I was 9. Now, I was the only child, and I felt, you know, all the attention went to my father. He ended up in hospital more in than out for 13 years with brain operations and everything. And so I started wagging school the day he went into hospital. I still remember it, you know, and that was the first day I wagged school. You know, I'm a single parent now with two boys, and I've got four teenagers at home living at home, both my sons and their girlfriends, you know, and it's a battle. But I want them to feel what I didn't feel in myself, love, you know. I felt, you know, and I understand, you know, I've been a single parent since my boys were in nappies, you know, and as a result of, you know, life situations. And I love to try and give that to other people. But for me, when I got locked up in Belterra, I felt, you know, I was scared and fearful at first, but I felt I was accepted. I felt a part of. You know? And now as a parent, I understand children love to, you know, live off their parents, you know, and family's, you know, attention, whether it's negative or positive. I seek a negative one. My parents were great, you know. But then it became normal for me. I got locked up in Tirana, and I felt I belonged. You know, and every time I was getting parole, when the parole sentences were starting, I'd run away just before. You know, and I'd come back with longer sentences. You know, and I'd become institutionalised, and I went to Barsby and then Pentridge. I was fearful, but I was with people on my own. You know, jail saved my life. You know, I'm a recovering drug addict, you know. I use drugs to give me confidence and make me feel good, and alcohol, you know.
So what then in the end got you out of jail, John? If you were so institutionalised, you felt so at home there, what has made you get out of jail now?
For me, I always wrote to my parents, you know, family, and if they had a girlfriend waiting outside, you know, when I get out, I'm going to get a job, get a car, get a licence. My parents didn't bring me up to, you know, wag school, do crime, go to court and go to jail. My parents, you know, they were workers, and, you know, they provided for me and done good things, you know. I consciously didn't feel right, and I always planned that. But I got to the point within myself, I'd had enough. The only thing that was changing for me in my life was the prison sentences were going from months to years, you know, and it was, you know, things weren't going too good, they were going worse. But I always had those plans to live life differently. And I heard other people that lived similar lives to myself that were doing that now, and I asked them for help.
So you asked for help, okay. So, and that's one of the things that came up after the chat this afternoon, was the necessary need for peers and assistance. I just want to ask you, though, I mean, in the play this afternoon, it was essentially, for those of you who didn't see it, it's an interview between a prisoner and a parole officer, and you were very aware of the performance. The performance in this case was inverted, but with the prisoner playing the parole officer and the parole officer playing the prisoner. But it was the performance of the parole. How many times did you go to a parole interview and give a performance and say you were going to do something which you had no intention of doing?
Like, for me, when I had parole interviews, you know, I had what they called a parole plan 6 weeks before getting out, then it's the parole board, and then they make a decision. You know, I'm going to go and do things right. And I meant it with all my heart, but I had that little thing in the back of my mind, you know, I'm going to go and catch up with my mates and go and get drunk and do one good robbery, and then I'll go and do that other stuff later. Because that's how my brain was wired. But deep down inside, you know, for me, alcohol and drugs become a problem for me. I've been sober and clean 10 years today. Australia. And I'm proud of it. Six foot tall and a half, saturated in tattoos, done over 10 years in prison, adult prison, and all the youth training centres, and I'm having a bit of a slip inside. Because I'm human. But when I went, had all these parole plans, I meant it with all my heart. And as a result of asking for help, I am a respectable member of the community today. I've got my own little lawnmower business. I'm a single parent with two kids.
You're an actor.
No, I'm being myself.
You're a performer.
For me, and with the chat, is to plant into this, into the minds of other people, plant a seed in the minds of other people.
Okay.
Once a crim, always a crim is alive. We're human beings. We've just made mistakes. And once an addict, always an addict is alive. I accept that I am. And I have scarring from my past. And I'm scarred, and I'll probably be scarred until the day I die. There was a lot of bad things that happened in there. My sons, they're all got Aboriginal boys due to a failed rehab romance, and they're going through their own journey, and I feel really powerless. One's just cleared up his court cases. He was locked up once for 8 days in Parkville, and pray that he won't go back there, but he's going all right now. My other son's back into football, and I'm going to be a granddad. All the stuff I dreamt about is happening, but I feel powerless. They're going to go and live their own experience in their own life, and all I can do is love them and be there for them and let them know the front door's always open. But I have boundaries. Can someone tell me how to follow through with boundaries?
I've got a 4-year-old. I'm already having problems with boundaries. I could do some advice from you. I just want to bring in Susan here, and then, sir, I promise I will come to you, because she's the only panellist we haven't really heard from yet. And Susan, John just brought up there the issue of addiction, which is such a prominent issue in our prison system. When you did time, it was to feed an addiction. So you might want to talk about that. But I'd just also be very interested in hearing from you what effect going to prison in your later years actually had on you, whether it was rehabilitative, whether you saw it as punishment, whether you felt that you deserved that punishment.
Well, yes, I did a crime, so I had to go to prison for that crime. But what this chap here was saying about addiction, my feeling about addiction, and it's not a unique point of view, is that it numbs pain. And I read things and I listen to people, and one of the questions we should be asking is not why the addiction, but why the pain. But we don't ask that question.
Were you asked that question in prison?
No. What? No.
Were you asked the question why the addiction in prison?
I wasn't no, because the thing is, by the time you get to the magistrate, for most people, in my case, for example, I'd lost everything before I got to the judge.
Mm-hmm. And to be specific, your addiction was in particular, if I remember correctly, was a pokey addiction.
It was a gambling addiction.
Gambling addiction.
I hate that word, pokey.
Okay.
Okay, gambling addiction. So I put $1 million in 10 weeks into poker machines. Some of it wasn't mine. So I had to go to prison, of course. By the time I got to the judge, I'd lost my relationship, my job, my house, my friends, the respect of my colleagues. So by the time I was standing in front of the guy, the judge, it was just, to me, purely punitive what he was going to do, and it happened to be 2 years in prison with 2 years parole. It's one of the worst experiences of my life, but not maybe why people would think, just that it's... For some people, it's just geography. Going to prison, if you're doing nothing on the outside and you go to prison and you're doing nothing, that's a big deal. But I had a good life and I missed it. And the experience was extremely enervating and almost really killed me, just the sheer boredom and disinterest of the people in there. And you just read stuff when you're outside and you don't actually know. It's, say, $95,000 to keep a person in prison. The prisoner only gets $5,000 of that a year. You get $5 a day. You eat shit. it's like the Truman Show, you know, there's a facade with a sign that says education, but there's actually nothing behind it.
Mm-hmm. But you say that you felt that you deserved to be punished, though, and that
well,
was
I
the
did
role.
A crime, so yeah. I deserve to be punished, but yeah. I think that if you want to fool yourself into thinking that it's a reformatory, it's not. So when I came out, it was difficult. You leave with a $160 crisis payment and a green garbage bag, and you know, you're in crisis accommodation, then you're in transitional accommodation. And the thing is, I studied youth work at one point in a different life that I had, and we talked about this really old-fashioned term called social role valorization, which means a valued social role for every member of the community. This fellow's got one now, you know, like he already said, he feels valued, he feels good. Prisoners don't get them. We don't get them. That's just a fantasy. And, yeah, there's 200 people in Dame Phyllis Frost, 250, 300 capacity maximum, and most of those women are in there for shoplifting, drug crimes. Mm.
And many of them have been victims themselves of crimes, particularly
domestic violence,
abuse.
And,
yep.
And bashings and shit. And, you know, there's a lot of prostitutes in prison. It's a, you know, but they do they deserve to be in prison? No, I don't think so.
You're bringing up a lot of themes there, amongst them housing, the women who are in prison and the reasons that they get there. But this gentleman's been very patiently waiting so for a while, so if I can get the microphone back to him, please.
Thank you. My name's Mick O'Brien. I first went into a correctional institution when I was 14 years of age. I'm now 73, so that's nearly 60 years of working in corrections. One of the key performance indicators for executives...
Sorry, just to be clear, you work or you're working in prison?
I was in the institution with a group called the Young Christian Students.
Okay.
And we went in and we related to kids who were the same age as ourselves.
Okay. So not as a prisoner?
No, I wasn't.
All right.
So, as I say, one of the key performance indicators for corrections is that people come out of prison no worse than they went in. And that's as high as they put it for the executives of corrections. And unfortunately, most people do come out worse than they went in. Mm-hmm. I went on from working in prisons as a young person like that with the Young Christian Workers, where I visited the youth offenders group, and the need for legal representation is very important, because in one year I organised appeals for 68 young offenders who had appeared in the magistrate's court without any representation, and all of them received custodial sentences. When I did appeals for those, organising legal representation for them, every one of them then got a non-custodial sentence.
Debbie, does that still happen?
It still happens,
many people
and it is worse now. When Haddon Story and Durack first set up the Legal Aid Commission, it was a bigger form of the Fitzroy Legal Service, of which I was a foundation member. Mm-hmm. But then when it got kennetised and Jane Ward was there, legal aid started to go downhill, and now it is a joke.
Okay, thank you. Debbie, so that's still a big issue that you deal with, is it?
Not legal representation. Absolutely. Well, we know that, you know, over 80% of young people in youth prisons are there on remand. So, and then, so say, for example, Queensland, where I come from, the biggest women's prison at Brisbane Women's at Wacol has about 270 women, massively overcrowded. Over 50% of them are either on remand or for breaches of minor breaches of their parole. So about 45% are actually sentenced women serving sentences. So, you know, we could reduce the prison population overnight by getting women out on bail, as well as, you know, stop the breaches because they forgot to go to a parole appointment, for example. You know, if you're homeless, you actually forget what day it is and you're more interested in a feed than Garland Senior Parole Officer.
Yes, sir.
I'd like to make a comment that I think the sort of geopolitical thing is where we should be going. We should be looking at what Sweden's doing. We should be looking around the world, what's going on.
What's Sweden doing?
Well, you know, in the 60s, the Dutch and the Swedes were on about this idea that prison wasn't just a place to lock people up. But the bigger things that I'm talking about is things like economics. Why are none of these big companies paying tax? Why do we have a Prime Minister who can't even say sorry to the Aboriginal community? We had a Prime Minister who said that homeless people, his policy was, it's their choice. We've got a systemic problem in society. We've got to look at the big picture, why people are, you know, are causing crime. And I don't want to sound too left-wing here, but capitalism eats its children. We advertise crap, we turn our people into crap, and if you go on Facebook and you hear the people, they talk about criminals as garbage. And so they become garbage. Now, this incident on the TV about these young people, the Northern Territory, there was more outrage about a gorilla that was shot, because these people are out of sight and out of mind.
Is that really true? There's been a fair amount of outrage today, to date this week, I think, about the treatment of the kids in the Don Dale.
I would say, yes, 10% of the intellectuals got up, a few people, but the, what I call the public TV set, you know, they're not interested. They'd rather watch The Voice or something else. Mm-hmm. There's this denial of intellectual issues.
Peter, if I could just... Oh, sorry, I'll come to you in a second, next, after Peter. Just this separation between us and them, is that something that you have come across not only in your work in as a prison chaplain, but, you know, criminals and non-criminals? Is that something that you've come across in your range of work as at Jesuit Social Services, just that divide? And how, and if that is an issue, is that an important issue?
It's in January, it's 40 years since the Brosnan Centre was started, which was January 1977. John, who spoke earlier, was a resident there for a short time. Look, once you get a criminal record, even in those days, but certainly today, your prospects of employment are pretty limited. You might be lucky with the CFMEU or the MUA, but you're not going to get employment anywhere
Malcolm
else.
Malcolm Turnbull would love to hear you say that.
Well, I don't want to add fuel to that fire. But look, 30 years ago I went to Sweden and Holland and saw successful programs. I'd been to the United States and England and saw unsuccessful programs. But they're running programs there, as the gentleman suggested. They've got low crime, low reoffending, small imprisonment. Within Australia, though, we've got a lot of diversity. I mean, Queensland, Northern Territory, Western Australia, I mean, what they do with juveniles compared to what Victoria's tried to do over the years, I would say, I don't want to praise Victoria too much, but we have a very, very small juvenile detention population. Mm. We want to keep people off remand if they're juveniles, because once you put them there, now sometimes it's necessary, but if you're doing that story, the people who are fearful of crime, out in that community, Tarnit and Company, they would feel that strongly. But if you put someone away from their community, away from their family, even for a week or two, that's where it starts. And in Victoria, we know that. We've got, you know, half the prison population of New South Wales and Victoria. We've got a small fraction of the people in juvenile detention in Victoria compared to New South Wales, Queensland, Northern Territory, Western Australia. I mean, there's things wrong with our system, I'll always say that. But if you get targeted with a criminal record, it's very hard to move on in life. And that's why in Victoria, diversion programs dealing with complex needs like access to good education. If you did a survey of the Victorian prison system or even the kids in prison, do they have access to good education, good schools? Have they got prospects for employment? And when you've got social change, particularly with groups coming with refugee background from Africa or from the Middle East, I mean, they need special care to resettle. And, you know, second generation are going to have trauma. Mm. Within this African group, there'd be one or two serious offenders there.
But there's another group of 50 or 100 that you've got to treat really carefully to avoid them getting drawn in.
Mm.
Most of those kids are still going to high school every day.
And actually, just as you bring up that, I was talking with a South Sudanese youth worker yesterday who was, and those of you who are familiar with it will be aware that there has been this extremely overblown, according to the police, issue with South Sudanese youth getting involved in carjacking. It's not just a South Sudanese issue, it's certainly an islander issue. It's a white, half of the people who are incarcerated for that or have been picked up for that are white, if you ask the cops. But that's not the impression that we have. The South Sudanese youth worker that I was talking to was saying a lot of the issues that they have are between cultural divisions in Australia. The kids go to school, they get taught that they have rights and that they can tell their parents what they want to do. That's not the South Sudanese more traditional way. The parents feel disempowered and there's this sort of cultural schism, I suppose, and that helps to feed into it. That's just something that I've learnt over the past week as I've been doing my story. But, ma'am, just in the back row, second back row, you wanted to make a point. And then I'd like to get some more comments from the audience because we're already running out of time and I'm sure that many of you have some comments and questions.
Yes. Am I on? Can you hear me?
Go for it.
Yeah. Hello, my name is Barbara and I think this dialogue is really good, but I feel sometimes the victim of crime is ignored.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I've been a victim of crime. I was in a post office just mailing something and someone came in with a 12-gauge shotgun pointed at my face. So it was highly traumatic. And what I found the worst thing is that I had to go to court and give my testimony of what I saw. So I gave my name and where I lived to the perpetrators that were sitting there. So that was very traumatic for me. And I think sometimes in a dialogue like this, victims never get a chance to speak. Like the Four Corners was excellent, but I didn't hear from one victim. Not one person said anything about how they were traumatized by a young boy, as sad as it is.
I mean, some people might argue that that's a separate issue from what was actually going on and the appropriate treatment of those young people. But as a victim, could you tell us now, what was the effect of that hold-up on you? How did that affect your life?
Well, I got a little bit agoraphobic because I was afraid to leave in case they tracked me down and found out, you know, that I was, because of my evidence, they were put to jail.
Hmm.
Now, did I want them to go to jail? Or did I want them to be set free and say, don't do that again? I mean...
So you wanted them to go to jail? You wanted them to be punished?
I wanted them to be punished because it was... I don't know how many people sitting here have had a gun pointed at their face.
I've had a gun pointed at my face and it was pretty terrifying and it affected me for... I got a little bit agoraphobic for a while. Anyone else been the victim of a crime here who might have something to add about this? Who would like to talk about what that experience was and what it meant to them? You're moving your hand very much in the front row, so I feel like I should go to you, sir.
I'm self-praise is no recommendation. I'm not here to praise what I've been through, but I'm there's not many of me left. I'm a H Division rock breaker. In 1974, I went to prison and got sentenced to 3 months imprisonment, convicted by a racist jury. I'm of Greek descent with a big, long Greek surname, and I believe that had the jury had a Papadopoulos or Kononopoulos, etc., in the jury, I would have been acquitted. But to cut a long story short, I was sentenced to 3 months, 12 months imprisonment with a minimum of 3 months. And when I went in, we had a little bit of a jack-up about the food. So for that, they sent me to a place called H Division, 74, and they wanted me to break rocks. And they ran into my cell for 3 mornings in a row with batons and broke bones in my hand, battered me ribs, the whole lot. It was horrific. I was a 19-year-old boy. I'd never been in boys' homes.
So do you feel like you were the victim of a crime then?
Well, that's a crime. There were monsters back in them days,
okay.
The prison officers.
Mm-hmm.
Kids, boys, men were flogged. you know, to break rocks and to have that put on you.
And presumably
created monsters.
Nothing
you know?
Ever happened to those prison officers who
no,
broke your hand.
No, not at all. I mean, 80-something percent of people who broke rocks in Hayes Division released committed murders, you know, like as Father Brosnan, going back a little bit longer than Peter, Father Brosnan said they come in for bike theft, stealing bicycles and become murderers. You know?
I'd just like to stick with the theme of the victims for a while because I'd be interested to hear if anyone else had an experience with that. James, sure. Yes, yeah, please. And, yeah, thank you very much. And that's why I want to expand on that theme a little bit because...
And I think I just want to, first of all, acknowledge it and say that's terrible. I'm really sorry. And secondly, my motivation for getting involved in working with former prisoners and trying to, you know, perhaps agitate reform somehow or be part of reform in criminal justice is that, and probably the reason why we do focus on offenders so much, is that I think we are all motivated to find out why this happens and find solutions. And I think it's not an excuse for why victims do get overlooked sometimes, but I think it's a natural thing that we're doing, and I think it's a good thing. While I'm really sorry what happens to you, I think it'll probably be the case that we will focus on offenders until we solve some of these problems.
And can I just say, when I went to the Victims of Crime Court, I had a very good judge, so I did get compensated by money for the trauma that I went through. So it's a very good system for the victim.
Can I just ask as well, did you want your... I mean, presumably you wanted the person who perpetrated this crime against
well,
you never to do it again.
They were repeat offenders.
Right. So your hope would have been that they wouldn't do it again.
Well,
but
I never had dealings with the police in my life before.
Yeah.
Never. And so I got to know the detectives... And they worked really hard, and they were very courteous to me. I don't know, maybe because I'm a white female. I don't know. But when they were in court, one of the questions was I led on by the police in my testimony?
Yeah.
And I felt really undermined then that what I was saying wasn't the truth, but the police were very good to me.
Is there anyone else who was a victim who'd like to add their experience? Is that you then?
I don't want to talk about the specifics of having been a victim of crime, but I do want to say as someone who has been a victim of crime and as someone who has worked a lot with women who's experienced crime and someone who has a family member, as James and others know, who has been in jail, the thing that terrifies me is that what we increasingly say to people is you shouldn't be violent, we send them to jail, and all the things that we tell people that they shouldn't do to their partner or to strangers, we do to them worse and in more extended ways in prison. So my concern is that the myth is that prison is rehabilitation, but jail breaks people in extraordinary ways, intentionally and deliberately, and violence is used to break people in jails. So to do that to someone and then say, and don't do that in the community, that you win when you're biggest and harshest in a prison, and that's usually the jailers, sometimes the prisoners, and then say, don't do the same thing at home when you're the biggest one, it doesn't work, we see that. So what I see is that there's a myth about addressing violence through jailing people, but we're just creating more violence, and we're not addressing why people behave in the way they behave, and we're not addressing the systemic disadvantages and the systemic discrimination, which means some people, other people sent to jail. Not all criminals go to jail.
We've got about 10 minutes left. Thank you. We've got about 10 minutes left. I did just want to hear from the cast member of the chat who's in the back. I missed your name during the performance. I apologise.
My name's Arthur. I'm an ex too. But I've been out of prison for 33 years this year. I'm a criminologist, by the way. I always throw that in because I'm not just an ex-crim with an opinion. I'm a qualified one. No, I say that very seriously. Very seriously. But, you know, I've been to a lot of forums like this, and at one stage I thought I'm not going to any more forums like this because they all agree. They're all nice people. Like, the audience are all nice. They're so affirming. I actually played the role of the bad guy. I didn't want him to get out. There's all this... It's almost treacly sweet and nice. But the reality is... I'm still fucking stigmatised after 33 years. Like, am I rehabilitated? I hear that. People ask all the time, rehabilitation. I say, what the fuck are you talking about? Rehabilitation, what the hell is that? How can you get rehabilitated in prison, for goodness sakes? Whether it was 30 years ago or yesterday, the fundamentals are the same. It doesn't help people who are already damaged, and I'm damaged. And it's taken me so many years to actually understand that, how damaged I am. Two friggin' failed marriages, a string of damage. And I kind of get so frustrated and I think, what do you want from us? What do you want from me?
Do you think that you owe anything to society?
No, absolutely not. What do I owe to society?
Do you think society owes anything
Bloody
to you?
Bloody oath it does. Do you know what it owes me? The right to be a fully fledged fucking citizen. Sorry. No, don't clap. It's not about clapping. This is the reality. And this is me. I'm edumacated. You know, I've got a family. I walked out of jail and I had a lot of support. Maybe that's one of the reasons I never went back. But there are people I know who are good friends of mine, and I'm an emotional goose too, but I've almost got to the stage, honestly, where I've given up. Short of a miracle, they're stuffed. They're fucked. And so today, the only energy I have left and will is to try and invest it into the lives of young people. And Jesuit Social Services, and I say this, and I'll say it in this forum too, they did research which said it all. 50% of all Victorian prisoners derive from 6% of frigging postcodes. If we as a society know that, and the politicians bloody well know that, why don't they go into those postcodes and capture those little kids, those little boys in particular, before they end up in juvenile detentions and ultimately in adult prison? I'm sick and tired of the process. I wish I could just change my life and go and do something else, but I can't because I'm sort of one of them too. Anyway, don't clap because I didn't get up to say that to clap, but I do get frustrated with this stuff.
Thanks, Arthur.
I'm not going to clap, but I don't want us to forget about the girls either, because women are the girls, and women are the fastest growing segment of prison population, not only in this country but in the Western world, and particularly Aboriginal girls and women, and they are forgotten about. And yes, if we know the postcodes like we do in Queensland, that's what we need to be sorting out. But look, we don't. And this stuff about, do I deserve to be punished? Don't I deserve to be punished? Am I a criminal? Am I not? Yeah, I was in prison, so therefore I was a criminal. Yeah, I'm a lawyer now. So where do you fit me? Where do you fit old mate over here? Where do you fit us in your thinking? Because you're many things in your lives too, just as we're many things and have experienced many things in our lives too. But we can't forget about the women. Because those women, over 85% of those women have children that are left behind, and then they're sucked in through the vacuum cleaner of trauma through so-called child protection, where we know Aboriginal kids are just removed at a massive rate than any other child that's living in poverty, and then who gets pipelined into the youth prison and into the adult prison. It all serves a purpose, and that is to socially control all of you out here, because you don't want it happening to you, so you stand back and allow it happening to us and Aboriginal people, people who live in poverty. And it's time that we cross those borders, so to speak, invisible borders of your whiteness and privilege, to actually move forward and call out to close them down. I don't agree with any type of violence at all, and I'm sorry to hear about your story of that violence, because that's horrendous violence. And as an abolitionist and abolitionists, we don't agree with prisons. We want them all shut down, but we don't, you know, accept anyone who's going to violate someone else. And there needs to be something else in society for people who are violent to others.
So Debbie,
and so let's think outside the bars and not just one replacement to a prison, because that's where we get bogged down.
Okay, so I was just about to ask you to expand further on your ideas of, if we get rid of prison, where do we go? And where do we go to satisfy the needs of people who have been victims of crime, who do feel the need to see that perpetrator punished, for one, and then the issues of community safety, and then the issues of rehabilitation. How do we go about that?
You're doing the same thing. You're saying offender, victim, like we're two separate entities. Mm-hmm. We're actually not. The high majority of women in prison are victims of horrendous violence, absolute horrendous violence, from a very young age. You know, over 89% have experienced rape and sexual abuse from a very young age and multiple times before they even hit the prison gates. And the way that they deal with that pain is to self-medicate, which what we were talking about a minute ago. And, of course, if you self-medicate with illegal drugs, you're going to collide with the cops and you're going to end up criminalised and imprisoned. So we've got to stop the violence in our communities. So it's about how we want a community to be, instead of just accepting prisons have to be there. Prisons don't have to be a part of that. It's how do we rearrange our society? And it's going to be very difficult because capitalism, which has captured us all, and once again, property is more valued than people. Mm-hmm. It's how we view our world and how we want our world to be. And it can start just with your neighbours and the street that you live in or the unit block that you live in, and negotiate those relationships and how you interact differently, how you resolve conflict, for example.
So just on a very practical note, and to wrap up, because we've gone over time because we started a bit late, and got about 2 minutes left, I'm afraid. But for the lady up here who was the victim of a terrible crime, she's only been the victim. She's never been the perpetrator. So how does she get justice, and how do we treat the person who did that to her if we're to get rid of prisons? What should we be doing to or with the perpetrator of her crime?
Well, in an ideal world, that one, we wouldn't have guns, would we?
Well, let's just forget about that.
I don't think we can forget about that. But we have to stop. Guns have to be destroyed, from whether we have them or cops have them or the army has them. Guns have got to go.
Okay.
Weapons have to go.
So that's a separate and bigger issue. So let's just assume that...
I think we're talking about a huge issue.
We are.
I can't say I'm going to resolve this issue with the woman here if we don't live in the society that I'm thinking about. So one, we wouldn't have guns, and so that wouldn't happen. But all right, so the guy's got a gun, or the few men, and they've come to rob the place. And it's a robbery, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, what I would be doing, of course they have to be removed from society, but prison makes them more violent. And actually prison, you know, you can be like a big fish in a little pond in a prison, you know, mm-hmm. and get lots of slaps on the back. But, I mean, really they're little fish in a big pond out of here. And so it's about, you know, the underlying issues. Why are they robbing that place? I would want to know why they're robbing the place. What are they after, you know? Obviously it's great fear to get money. Was it about, yeah. And so money becomes the object, you know, that's the priority for them. I can only imagine that it wasn't a priority to hurt anybody, but they did, because it was about getting money. So for example, my mate who runs a bank, I used to always say to her, if armed robbers come running in there, just hit the deck and give them the fucking money, because they're only there for the money. And they did get robbed once, and she remembered me saying that, and they did all drop to the floor and just said, take the money and go, and no one got hurt. Mm-hmm. And no one had a gun shoved in their face. But it's about that understanding, unpacking, and try to do some resolution between the woman there and the man or the men who shoved the gun in her face, whether those parties can come into a safe environment and have a conversation. Like what it meant for you to be that victim and how horrendous it was, and for them to understand what the fuck they've done to you and those other people. Because I can imagine they would have no idea, because they were probably on drugs, wanted money to buy more drugs.
Okay. I'm just going to go to John for the final word, because it's a Saturday night and we've been talking for an hour and we're already 15 minutes over time.
I'll be really quick. You know, I've got to think. I just went to court the other week with my son. He had some alcohol stuff, and he reacts with violence, and, you know, he bashed a couple of blokes on the bus. You know, and we went to court. And I thought, how can he make amends? You know, he was going to get locked up over it, because there were serious charges. You know, and I mentioned to the magistrate, you know, is there any way, possible way, that it can meet up with the victims? Because the victims are harmed and they live with that. And I understand that because I suffered a lot of guilt and shame over victims that I had harmed, I ended up robbing houses when I was 11 and ended up robbing banks, So things changed. I harmed people. One lady, sent to me in prison, about compensation. She's never worked in a bank again. That affected her family and everything like that. And I felt guilt and shame. So I mentioned in court, to the magistrate, is there any way that my son can meet up with the victims, if they're willing, because the victims need to be willing too, and to try and set things right between themselves,
Did that happen?
And that's happening on the 15th of August.
Mm-hmm. And so, you feel that would be the best thing for him to...
For him and the victims too, because they were hurt really bad. Mm-hmm. And I found it's about healing in both parties.
Healing, that's a word we haven't discussed this evening.
Yeah, healing. It's about healing and feeling good about themselves and letting go. Because for me, I've had to let go of my past. Mm. And I'm really grateful of the life that I live today, because I created hope from other people. Because hope, hearing other people's experience, that something could be different. I'm getting soupy. And for me, I like me today. There's still that little bit. I'll let someone else talk.
There is one real glaring issue here, is the fact that over many years of, the last 10 years or 15 years, perhaps 20, all our community centres in Victoria have been closed down. And as a direct result, the young ones, white and black, that do access our community, had accessed our community, they need to buy a workshop. Because these places have been closed, there's nothing for people, young ones up in Horsham to do, to gravitate towards. So we need to refund that. Mm-hmm. And somebody like me, I'll have a talk with me old mate, the Premier, and I'll tweak it to the possibility of, let's get back to basics. We need our workshops open in all our small communities in the state of Victoria to open and showcase to other states that this is possibly a way to go. Magistrates are dying to be able to send somebody to a community centre of honesty and integrity instead of sending them to jail. I'm already talking with the magistrates, Mr. Fanning in the Neighbourhood Justice Centre. The best thing to happen in Collingwood, Fitzroy, since sliced bread, that we've got this. And he loves the idea of, if I had started the Nindabaya workshop in Melbourne, being allowed to be taken seriously enough by the system, by Dickie Wynne and etc. and the Yarra Council, to reopen the new modern Nindabaya workshop and that. I could, head people off at the pass. Our organisation can do this. Well, and spread it into our Horsham, Shepparton and Maroopna and Echuca and all that. We need this to happen again. Funding needs to go into our community centres.
Well, I reckon if anyone can do that to Dan Andrews' ear, I reckon it's probably you, Jack. So thank you. Thank you very much. And look, just to go back to what John was saying about us needing hope, we do have to wrap it up this evening, but hearing other people's experiences, as you say, is really fundamental to not only improving our society, but actually understanding our society, which is the very basis of improving our society. So can I thank those of you who have contributed this evening, your experiences, and particularly our panellists, Jack Charles, Peter Norton, Debbie Kilroy, Susan Shepherd, James Brennan, and thank you very much to all of you for coming out. We've run out of time. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.